back. But he stole. So if he pays back, he can get out. And the other one is if he himself feels that he can't support himself, etc. So he sells himself.
But is there an added amount or subtracted amount to his debt? Not interest, but
he works it off. So he works it off. You know, every year is a certain percentage of his debt that's worked off.
Okay. Thank you.
Decades of anti-Semitism go in waves. The 1930s was a decade of extreme anti-Semitism in the world. Our generation, the decade of the 90s and our time is also a repetition somewhat of that time. Now, in the 30s, the anti-Semitism was abetted. I don't want to say it's caused, because there's no rational cause for it. But it was abetted by certain events that occurred. One event was the Great Depression of 1929, which lasted throughout the 1930s in almost every country in the world except Germany and Japan, both of whom rearmed, and because of the rearming were able to have employment and to finance their recoveries. But the Great Depression really was a crushing blow to Western society. We have in the United States, you had an unemployment rate of over 15%. You had millions of people who didn't have what to eat. You didn't have all of the programs that are in place today, the government programs to help people who lose their positions or who are on welfare. None of that existed then. So the Jews were a natural scapegoat, because the Jewish financiers on Wall Street in the 1920s were extremely prominent in the bubble, the great bubble of the speculative stock market. There were no limits then on borrowing. There were no margins. So people speculated, and thousands of families, tens of thousands of families were ruined when the stock market collapsed. And because Jews were and are very prominent on Wall Street in the securities and finance business, so that drew attention to Jews in the search for a scapegoat. On the opposite side of the coin, which is probably more insidious than anything else, was the fact that the Bolshevik revolution in Russia and the Bolshevik government in Russia had a large amount of Jews involved, completely disproportionate to the Jewish population. So you had in Lenin's original Politburo, you had 19 people, seven of whom were Jews. You You had Trotsky and Zinoviev and Kamenev and Sverdlov, all of these people who were Jewish, were prominent Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks under Stalin were tremendously ruthless. In the 1920s, in order to force the peasants to leave their farms and join collective farms, Stalin starved to death 5 million people. Took all the food away. 5 million Russian peasants died in the Great Famine. And the famine was a man-made famine. Wasn't the product of locusts. In the 1930s, Stalin purged the Communist Party with great show trials, and it was the Great Terror. There's a book called The Great Terror, which points out all of these things. And Jews were very, very prominent in it. Naturally, at the end, Stalin got rid of all of them, too. I mean, to be Stalin's executioner meant for certain that you were going to get executed, too. You go to Yezhev, all of the people who headed the secret police and the executioners, they all got executed themselves. At the end, Beria. But it created a climate. The famous rabbi of Moscow, Rabbi Jacob Maza, said to Trotsky, he said, Trotsky makes the revolution, but Bronstein pays the price. Bronstein was Trotsky's Jewish name. And by that he meant that the Jewish people suffer because of the acts and behavior of these ruthless revolutionaries. Now, in every country in Europe, there was a threat of communist takeover, except in England. But there was a threat that the communist parties were strong. The communists, in their own way, contributed to the rise of Adolf Hitler. Their riots on the streets brought out the Nazi riots. And eventually, what is entirely fascinating is that all the communists became good Nazis, with the exception of those that Hitler naturally killed. But the rank and file of the Communist Party became the rank and file of the Nazi Party, because totalitarianism loves totalitarianism. In France, there was a Jewish prime minister by the name of Léon Blum. And he was a socialist. He was head of the socialists. The socialists and the communists in the 1930s combined for the French elections. They called it the United Front. And they won a majority in parliament. In the 1930s, with Hitler in power in Germany, a Jewish prime minister in France could not afford to appear to be too strong against the Nazis in Germany, because they would say, that's because he's Jewish. Just as the American Jewish community was very quiet in the Second World War, because of the fact that the anti-Semites said that it was a war that America entered in order to save Jews. It was a Jewish war. You hear echoes of that today regarding the American participation in Iraq, that the anti-war people, many of whom are Jews themselves, say that the reason that Bush is so adamant in staying in Iraq is to protect Israel. Or the reason that Bush is so adamant against Iran having nuclear weapons is to protect Israel. And so that's a refrain that happens over and over again. And so in the 1930s, a man like Leon Blum could not afford to say that France will stand strongly against Hitler and against all of his demands and will not allow them to happen. Because if he did so, then he was not loyal to France, he was loyal to the Jews. The fact that France would pay an enormous price for that short-sightedness really went unnoticed. It's a funny world we live in. So you had that. Then you also had a civil war in Spain that broke out in the middle of the 1930s. There was a Republican government in Spain, socialist, and the army revolted against the government, and the army was led by a man by the name of Francisco Franco, who was the head of the French and the Spanish army in Morocco, in Africa, because then the Spanish Morocco belonged to Spain. And he took the army and he invaded Spain. And there was a over 2.5 year bitter civil war with tremendous atrocities on both sides. And the civil war was supported by outside forces. Franco was supported by Germany and by Italy, and Mussolini and Hitler. And the German Air Force practiced, the Luftwaffe practiced for the war in Spain. And the Russians, the communists, the left, supported the Republican forces. And that also was a practice session. But all of those who fought, all the Russians who fought on behalf of the Republic, when they came back to Russia, Stalin either executed them or exiled them. Because they were already contaminated if they were in the West. So they caught the disease, so then he had to get rid of them. Now, there were leftists, for instance, in the United States, that organized a brigade, it was called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, that traveled to Spain to fight on behalf of the government. Again, a disproportionate amount of members of the brigade were Jewish, because the Jewish left in the United States was very, very strong. There was a large socialist base of Jews in the United States. Today it is modified into the liberal base, which votes Democratic in every election, no matter what, and sees itself in its, you know, in its self-righteous clothing. But the in the 1930s, they basically were socialists and communists, and that added another aura of danger. Anybody that looked at the Jewish people, because the Jewish people were identified as being socialists and communists. On one hand, they're identified as being ultra-capitalists who brought about the Depression. On the other hand, they are identified as being communists and socialists. So to a certain extent, you really can't win it, because whatever happens. Now, in the United States, I know it sounds strange because America has come a long way since, but in the 1930s, there was, for instance, a radio priest, a priest who preached on the radio every Sunday, Father Coughlin, who was a priest in Detroit, who was a rabid anti-Semite. He had a half-hour program on what was then the Mutual Network, which was the biggest network, radio network, was a time when everyone listened to radio. And it was just a half-hour diatribe against the Jews. Straight. Of course, in the 1930s, you have to remember that America was far different. I mean, you could have programs where people were ethnically targeted. You had Amos and Andy, which was a program about blacks, which portrayed them as lazy watermelon eaters, scheming, conniving. And it was an extremely popular program. Two white men provided the voices for the blacks whom they portrayed. Very popular program, Amos and Andy.
It was at top listening level.
Yeah, it was a very popular program.
And
then you had programs about Jews. You had a program called the Goldbergs, in which stereotyped the Jews, Molly Goldberg, etc., were portrayed. And then you had Abie's Irish Rose, which was a program about a Jewish man named Abie who married an Irish girl, Rose, and of the problems that come from that and how they overcome that. These are programs that today pretty much would be unthinkable as being not politically correct. But in the 1930s, these were the programs that appeared on American radio. Yes?
The Goldbergs became a very popular television.
Became a television show also later.
It was popular with Jews.
Yeah, well, Jews like to make fun of themselves.
Rabbi, do you think there's anything to the fact that a lot of the problems that we, I heard it on television, a lot of the problems we have, we put our own selves into as well, by lack of foresight sometimes, where we speak before we think?
That could be. That could be. Do not engage mouth unless mind is in gear. Now, in complicating all of this again was the fact that you had people like Henry Ford, who was the leading industrialist in the United States, who published a newspaper called the Dearborn Independent. And the Dearborn Independent was just an anti-Semitic rag. And you had people like Charles Lindbergh, who was the great American hero who flew across the Atlantic solo. And that made him a great hero. And what made him even a greater hero is that his son was kidnapped and killed. And so therefore the entire country's sympathies lay with him. And he became an ally of Hitler. He went to Germany and he said, Hitler is great and he's doing wonderful things and everything is terrific. In 1936 in the Olympics, the American team, Avery Brundage, who was the people that organized, I don't mean Avery Brundage, he's later, but the people who organized the American team in the Olympics were anti-Semitic, and they didn't want to offend Hitler. The Jews were pretty much excluded, even if they were entitled to be on. Of course, the revenge was taken by a black man, Jesse Owens, who won three medals, which Hitler refused to present to him. And, you know, the world swallowed it. And so this tremendous wave of anti-Semitism is really what encouraged Hitler to do what he did, because he felt, and correctly so, that he could get away with it, that no one would speak up against it. And that by saying that the Jews were the main problem in the world, so, you know, that's what they say, you know, before Sharon was in charge of the disengagement. So they said Sharon is worse than, you know, Sharon is the terrorist and Arafat is the peace lover. So that's the same thing that they said here. And the Jews had really nowhere to turn. In the United States, they had a fairly low profile, something which later they would not have, but they, again, in the United States, there was a German-American Bund of German immigrants to the United States who supported Hitler and who marched in the streets. I remember as a very, very small child in 1940, before America went into the war, but after the war had started already, that they still marched, and they had the mass rallies at the Chicago Stadium. They marched with Nazi flags. And so you had this climate that really limited whatever Jews could do. This would prove to be disastrous in the Holocaust, because the Jews had no influence, really, with any of the Allied governments to attempt to do anything regarding the Holocaust, which they practically did nothing. Militarily, they did nothing. They didn't bomb the railroad to Auschwitz. And diplomatically, they did nothing. And after the war, the perpetrators of all of the atrocities, 95% of them escaped without penalty.
I read, I don't remember the source, that the American policy was to leave all Nazi judges in place and not to replace judges.
Yeah, well, the American occupation forces left everybody. They were interested in rebuilding Germany, not in punishing Germans. And all the Nazi scientists were divided between Russia and America. All the rockets were made by the Germans. It was, it was a matter of different practicality, not a matter of judgment. Now, so in this climate, you also have to throw in the fact England had promised that it was going to support the establishment of a Jewish national home here in the land of Israel. That was the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Based on that Balfour Declaration, in the 1920s, the Zionists were successful in bringing a large number of Jews to the land of Israel. Most of the Jews who came were secular and leftist, because part of the promise here was not only to build a Jewish state, part of the promise here was that you were going to build the world's utopia, and you're going to have the perfect state, as envisioned by Marx. You're going to have communes, which with the kibbutzim are pure communism. And you were going to have all-powerful labor union, the Histadrut, which was the party in power. And that the country basically, as the leftists saw it, had to be anti-religious. And it saw the previous generations as a hindrance to achieving their utopian ends. So this movement into the land of Israel, which they felt they had British approval for, which they did originally, ran against great obstacles. The first obstacle was that England really reneged on the Balfour Declaration. It did so because of the fact that oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, and in many other places in the Persian Gulf, all of which were under English influence or control. and therefore oil was more important than the promises that were made. The second thing was that the Arabs, the Muslims, opposed with violence continued Jewish immigration into the country. Every 3 or 4 years there was what today we would call an intifada. 1923 and 1926 and 1929, the Jewish community in Hebron was destroyed. The British just stood idly by. So it became clear that England had no intention of honoring the Balfour Declaration. And England's policy was basically divide and rule. They wanted to keep the Arabs unhappy and the Jews unhappy, and they would both be unhappy, so therefore they would accept British rule. The British would be able to stay. That was British policy till the end. When England said that it was going to leave the country and the State of Israel was declared, England was convinced that the State of Israel would be overrun by the Arab armies in a matter of months, and therefore, in order to avoid the slaughter and the massacre of the 600,000 Jews in the land of Israel, they would beg England to return and protect them. And then that would like end the Zionist movement, and England would be ensconced again in the land of Israel. It didn't happen that way, but that's the way they thought it would happen. So you also had this ingrained English anti-Semitism against the Jews in the land of Israel. At a time when Jews needed immigration, in the 1930s, for instance, Hitler said, anybody that wants to leave Germany can leave. Until almost 1939, that was the case. But you had to have somewhere to go. And every door in the world was shut. The United States refused to relax its immigration quota to allow Jews to come in. Jews came to certain places, to South America. If you had money, you know, substantial money, you could buy your way in almost anywhere. But the average person, the middle class person, even the person that was a doctor or a lawyer or a professional, really had nowhere to go, and he had nowhere to get there. No way to get there, even if they wanted to go. So the Eastern European Jew was just locked in completely. People say, well, why didn't they? What were they supposed to do? How did 6 million people pick themselves up in one day and go? It just doesn't work that way. And because of all of this, the ground was laid for the terrible events of the 1940s for the Holocaust. And then all of the countries of Eastern Europe, the official governments, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, were all officially anti-Semitic. It wasn't that they, it wasn't personal, it was official. In Poland, the government didn't allow the Jewish businesses to operate fairly. They forced everybody, most Jewish businesses were able to be open on Sunday because they were closed on Saturday. And they, like the grocery store, right? So they passed Sunday laws that forced them to close. So even though that caused a great hardship to the local population because they had nowhere to buy on Sunday, but it destroyed the Jewish economy. They banned Shechita, limited it, all sorts of restrictions. The Jews became second-class citizens. And in Poland, Jews were beaten up on the streets or in the trains. The police never intervened. So it's not surprising that when the Germans came, they found willing collaborators to do all of these things, kill people, because that was the climate of the time. That's the demonization of a person, the demonization of a race, of a religion, of a people. And it has very dangerous consequences, just as in our time it has very dangerous consequences. Because if you say it long enough, and you say it often enough, then all of a sudden that becomes the fact. And that's a very, very dangerous situation for which we really have no response, yes? Well, you know, it's easy to say, but, you know, why didn't the people in Russia revolt against the communist oppression? Why didn't they, you know, you just, the terror is so great that then you couldn't buy weapons and, you know, you just couldn't do anything. It's, in theory, it says, well, you know, but in practice, it almost never works. Just as in the United States, for instance, there were very few slave rebellions before the Civil War. There were three or four slave rebellions, but you had 3 million people, you know, who could have destroyed the South. But it never happened.
There was a reason that a lot of these blacks were slaves there. They looked better than the whites, of course. So why would they?
Well, I doubt
they
it.
They didn't know that.
They didn't know that. It's just that because a slave has the mentality of a slave, and a person who's persecuted has the mentality of a person who's persecuted. Doesn't stand up for himself. And the Jews, don't forget, came from centuries of persecution. It was inbred within them. It was almost inbred that it was a violation of God's will to defend yourself. So all of that had an effect upon them. They really were unable to do much. Even in the war, the Jewish partisans were killed by the non-Jewish partisans. As many Jewish partisans died from non-Jewish partisans as died from the Germans. So that's the climate of thought. That's the climate that dominated. That really, you know, that says something about our time too. Okay, so this is the run-up to the Holocaust, so to speak. In the run-up in the United States. After the war in 1945, there were a few hundred thousand Jews who were in they didn't call them refugee camps, they called them displaced persons, meaning that they were from places where they couldn't go back home. I mean, the Allies did a terrible thing, the United States and England. There were almost 3 million Russian prisoners of war who survived. There were 2 million that were killed by the Germans, but almost 3 million survived. And the Allies forced them to go back to Russia, where Stalin destroyed them. Because in the Russian army, if you were captured, that was a sign that you were a traitor.
Why did the Allies have this policy?
The Allies had the policy because they didn't want to provoke Uncle Joe. Later on, they would learn that the only way to deal with Uncle Joe was to provoke him. But in the beginning, they were very weak. They appeased him. I mean, Roosevelt was taken in completely by Stalin. Roosevelt says, oh, we can do business with Uncle Joe. He called him Uncle Joe. We can do business with Uncle Joe. And Stalin is the one that caused the Korean War. Because he and Chairman Mao figured that they'd be able to kill 1 million American soldiers and therefore leave Europe unprotected. Only later did they figure out what Stalin really was and what the Russians were and what kind of war it was. But at the beginning, this is what happened.
Weren't they wise by Potsdam?
What?
By Potsdam, didn't they know already? Truman, Stinson?
Well, they didn't know to the extent that they would know later. They were still they still had illusions. Still had illusions. They had illusions as late as, General Marshall visited China, and he said that Mao is terrific, right? The best thing that happened in the world. He should run it. He's better than Chiang Kai-shek. So America saved Mao. And Mao ended up killing 70 million Chinese.
Well, he supported Chiang Kai-shek in the Civil War.
Yeah, Chiang Kai-shek could have destroyed the communist army if America didn't hold him back. Now, there's a lot of mistakes, and there were a lot of leftists and communist agents and moles around. That it's not a very pleasant story. Now, as far as the Jews are concerned, you've got these few hundred thousand survivors of the Holocaust, and where are you going to go? So America took a small number, which they were entitled to take because the quota system allowed for certain Eastern European immigration. Since in the years of the war, there was no immigration, so therefore they could take advantage of the fact that a certain amount could come in. But most of them had nowhere to go. So they wanted to go to Palestine. The Zionist movement organized what they called the Bricha. Bricha means fleeing Europe. President Truman advocated that England should let in 100,000 Jews into Palestine, 100,000 of these refugees into Palestine. You have to remember there only were about 550,000 Jews in all of Palestine at the time. So this would be like a 20% increase in the Jewish population. Ernest Bevin, who was the British foreign minister, who was an anti-Semite, an open anti-Semite, the head of the British trade unions, Ernest Bevin said, well, he wants them in Palestine because he doesn't want them in Brooklyn. Which may have had a smidgen of truth to it.
Why was Bevin was the head of the English trade
unions? He was the head of the English trade unions. He was the second man in the British Labour Party. When the British Labour Party won the election in 1945 and Churchill was turned out of office, I don't know if it would have been better with Churchill. I mean, you can't play that game. But when they were turned out of office, Bevin became the foreign secretary. And he set up British foreign policy. And his foreign policy naturally was that they were going to keep the empire, or try to keep it. But they had a commitment to India, to give India independence. And they didn't realize, or maybe they did realize, that once they did that, though, it's like pulling a brick out from the wall, the whole wall is going to collapse, which it did. But they were not anxious to allow any Jewish refugees to come into Palestine. And therefore, the British imposed a blockade. The British Navy blockaded the shores of Palestine. The Jewish organizations, the Haganah and the Irgun, ran the blockade. 90% of the ships were caught. The people were forced into detention camps, either in Cyprus. The British held over 100,000 Jews in detention camps in Cyprus. Or, as in the case of the Exodus, the famous ship, they were sent back to Germany and forcibly removed from the ship. All of this raised and then the knowledge of the Holocaust, really what happened, all of this raised a cry in the world, a public opinion cry, that, you have to do something for the Jews. And therefore, the United Nations sent a commission in 1946 to study the problem here in the Middle East. It's the same problem that we have today. the solution to the problem always was two states, partition, divide the country, not realizing that the problem is not really as much territorial as it is existential. It's not that we cannot come to a satisfactory conclusion as to where the borders should be, or who has the right to the water, etc. All of those things can be negotiated. The problem is, how do you have a Jewish state that exists in the middle of a Muslim Middle East, which is an affront to the religion of Islam and to the Quran? And that's the problem that our great leaders refuse to look at, and therefore treat it as a different type of problem. As though if all the Palestinians had jobs, and you know, and everything, so then this would be the Rose Garden of the Middle East. But that's not recognizing your enemy, and that's not recognizing the reality of the situation. So, in any event, this United Nations Commission comes to here, and they have discussions with everybody, and they come up with a plan called the Partition Plan. Under the Partition Plan, Jerusalem will be internationalized, be an international city under the UN. 70% of the land mass, of the arable land mass of Palestine, will go to the Arabs. And Israel will be truncated, three sections, one section in the Negev, one section along the coast, Tel Aviv to Haifa, and one section in the Galilee. Borders that are almost ludicrous. But here you have this partition plan. So Israel agreed, the Zionists agreed to the partition plan. They said anything that we get is good enough. Later on we'll see what will happen. But the Arabs refused it, because the Arabs refused the whole idea that any sort of Jewish state should exist whatsoever here. And the Arabs threatened violence if the partition plan was adopted. It was brought to a vote on November 29, 1947 in the United Nations building in Lake Success, New York. And that's why there are streets in Israel that are Choftet in November. 29 November, and you needed a two-thirds vote. I mean, today, if it were brought to the United Nations, we would have four votes. I mean, we're very safe. The Marshall Islands is on our side, and Micronesia, and the United States and Israel. Those are the four votes. And the other 170 votes against are clear. But in 1947, it was not the case. They needed 32 votes to pass the resolution. And they got 33 votes. It was 33 to 13. With the Arab and South American Catholic countries voting against. The Vatican labored long and hard to have Catholic countries vote against it, and the Muslim countries voted against it. But by a miracle, one can only say, the whole thing here is the hand of God anyway. You see, it has to be the hand of God, because if God gave us good leaders, right, so that we could say, you know, we had a George Washington, we had an Abraham Lincoln, that's why it happened. But he gave us Yotsen, right? So nobody says, you know, it's going to happen because we're going to have Ehud Olmert, or because we had Sharon, or we had Rabin, or we had Netanyahu. Well, right? Look at the whole list, you know. All failed leaders. So it happened only because God wanted it to happen. The Medrash says, if I may be rabbinic for a moment, the Medrash says that why did God send Moshe Rabbeinu, who was kvad peh or kvad lashon, who stammered and stuttered and couldn't speak well? Because if God would have sent someone that's a great orator, so they would have said, he's a demagogue, he's able to do it, right? He can inspire people. So they would say, oh, see, he's the one who did it, right? So God sent somebody that couldn't be credited with that degree of inspiration and demagoguery, so that the people would have to say, well, it must be that God did it, because Moshe certainly couldn't do it. I think that's pretty much the situation here as well. But if we had, we had real leadership that we were proud of and that really did the job, and not everybody under indictment, so then we would say, well, they did it, right? So God gave us people that we cannot confuse the matter with, right? We cannot say that they're the ones that they were doing anything. Yeah. Excuse me, I have to sit. The Arabs were at the beginning of the 20th century. There were about 600,000 Arabs in the country. For every one Jew who immigrated to the land of Israel, two Arabs immigrated. And they came from Egypt and from Jordan, from all the surrounding countries. You just walked across. Right? So, all of the fictions about the houses that they owned and everything, most of that is just made-up stories.
So what was the attraction?
The attraction was that since the Jews were here, the life, the quality was much better. There were jobs, and they Arab countries have always been poor. There was a thin slice on top, and everybody else was nothing. But here, where the Jews developed the country, it's the same thing today. If they would open the borders, all the Palestinian Arabs would come to live here, not just because of political or diplomatic reasons, but economic reasons. Just as if the United States had no immigration quotas, half the world would move to the United States today.
That's what's happening
in Mexico. Yeah, Mexico. Mexico's greatest export are people. They tell you that. I mean, the president of Mexico said that almost one-third of all Mexican income is money sent by Mexicans working in the United States back home. So, you can figure that out by yourself. So the day after November 29th was the day that the resolution was passed. November 30th was the day when the war began. So the War of Independence doesn't begin May 15th, 1948. It begins November 30th, 1947. And the English, to a great extent, who still ran the country, the English supported the Arabs. There were many deserters from the British Army who fought with the Arabs. The Arab Legion of Transjordan was commanded by a British officer, John Glubb. The British turned over great stores of arms to the Arabs and confiscated whatever arms they could of the Jews. And so now there began a three-way war. There was one war of the Jews against the English, that war was mainly run by the Irgun and by what the British called the Stern Gang, the Freedom Fighters of Israel, the Lehi. So that was a war against the English to drive the English out of the country, to drive Britain out of the country. A lot of unpleasant things happened in that war. It was a dirty war. The British hanged a number of Jews. The Jews captured two British sergeants in the Irgun, and they hanged them in the public square in Tel Aviv. After that, there were no more hangings. The British isolated the Jewish sections here. There was a place that was called Bevengrad, which was the British headquarters. So here, Rehov Yafa, all of that was barricaded. Jerusalem immediately went under siege, because Jerusalem is supplied by the road from Tel Aviv. The road from Tel Aviv was cut by the Arabs in a number of places. The main place was near what is today Tel Stone, Castel, and at Latrun. And the convoys, you know, when you go by the road today, on the side of the road there are burnt out skeletons of vehicles from the 47-48 war. Today you just drive by and you don't even notice them anymore, but there was a time when they were much more prominent. But all of this was part of the blockade of Jerusalem. There was no food, there was no water, no medicine. Jerusalem was under siege for over 9 months. And constant shelling, sniping. The old city fell to the Jordanian legion. The Jews of the old city were taken into captivity. The situation was very bleak, very, very bleak. So that was one war. The one war was against the British. The other war was against the Arabs. And then there was the third war, the Jews against the Jews.
What war was that?
That war was between the Eitzel, the Irgun, which was led by Menachem Begin, and the Haganah, which basically was led by Ben Gurion. And Ben Gurion was a great builder. He was a man of vision, but he was a great hater. Even when he was prime minister and Begin was a member of the Knesset, he would never call him by name. He would say, the gentleman that's sitting next to Mr. Goldberg. Never called him by name. And the Irgun had its own private army and its own private resources. And it all came to a head when a ship called the Altalena came to dock in Tel Aviv Harbor, and on the ship were Irgun reinforcements, people from overseas who came to fight for the Irgun, as well as a large cargo of arms that had been purchased in Czechoslovakia that they were bringing into the country for the Irgun fighters. Ben-Gurion ordered the Haganah to stop it, and under the command of Yitzhak Rabin, who was then the lieutenant in the Haganah, the Altalena was shelled, exploded, destroyed, with quite a number of people killed. So then there was a fateful moment, whether there would be an open civil war here or not. And to Begin's everlasting credit, Begin said, we're not going to fight. And they gave up their arms and they became part of the general army of the Israel Defense Forces, though as a political movement, they were the counterbalance to the labor and to the left. And Begin eventually won an election in 1977 and became the prime minister, something which was unimaginable 30 years earlier. Begin was a great orator. He was a traditional Jew, not an observant, but a traditional Jew, in a warm spot for it. And during the years when he was hiding from the British, he hid in the disguise of a kollel young man with the beard and the hat and the long frock, the whole item. And because of the fact that he was a traditional Jew from Poland, he would be able to carry it off. Today, I don't think any of them could carry it off. You know, they put the yarmulke on, you know, in the peak of their head. And, you know. So, but Begin was able to do so. So you had this three-way war in this little country. The war against the British was successful. Britain decided that they were going to leave. They said they're going to leave May 15th, 1948. And May 14th, 1948, before sunset, it was Friday, Ben-Gurion declared the State of Israel to come into existence. It was a very close vote in the Zionist Council whether to do it or not. They were afraid to do it, many. But he prevailed. Ben-Gurion, he said, if we don't do it now, he said, it'll be 100 years till we have another chance. It's our only chance to have the state. And the moment the State of Israel was declared, both, again, the miracle is that Russia and the United States both agreed on this. And then after that, they didn't agree on anything for 50 years. But on this matter, they both agreed. They agreed to pass the resolution, the partition. And they both recognized the State of Israel immediately. Truman and Stalin both did so. And then seven Arab armies invaded the country. And the Arabs thought that they would have an easy victory because they were very well armed. The Syrians and the Lebanese were armed by the French. And the Jordanians and the Saudis and the Egyptians were armed by the British. And you had the Arab militia here within the country. So you had overwhelming numbers and overwhelming arms. But somehow they lost the war. And in losing the war, they lost a lot of territory from the original partition plan. And then they also lost about 700,000 Arabs left the country, fled. And this would be the beginnings of the refugee problem. Today the 700,000 have grown to 4.5 million because they've all been kept in refugee camps. They've not been resettled in any of the Arab countries. They're preserved in order to destroy the State of Israel. And these are people that you have today in Gaza and the West Bank. And there are camps still in Lebanon and in Syria also. There's generation after generation after generation, all supported by the United Nations. Yeah.
What percentage of them were, did you say, left voluntarily?
No one knows. And there are many Israeli claims that that we asked them to stay and they left. And then, but it's hard to know. It's hard to know. But there are 700,000 Sephardic Jews that were driven from the Arab countries that came to Israel to be resettled. But here, they were resettled. They weren't kept in camps. There they were, which makes a great difference. Okay, we'll continue on this next time.
Shalom aleichem.
Thank you.
10:30.